listening to a program produced in 2010 as part of Aloud, a series of dynamic lectures, readings, performances, and discussions that take place in the Mark Taper Auditorium at the historic downtown Central Library in the heart of Los Angeles. These programs are presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles, which supports the Los Angeles Public Library. To learn more about Aloud, please go to our website, www.aloudla.org. Tonight, it's my great pleasure to introduce Laura Scandera Trombley, who's an internationally known Mark Twain scholar. She's going to speak about her illuminating portrait of one of America's favorite authors. Her book is called Mark Twain's Other Woman, and it concerns the enduring mystery of Samuel Clemens' last decade from 1900 to 1910. As documentary filmmaker Ken Burns wrote, Twain continues to give long after his death. Now we have Laura Trombley's fascinating narrative of his last days and his little-known relationship with Isabel Lyon. The pieces begin to fall into place. The funniest man on earth is revealed to be a much more complicated soul. It was Twain, after all, who said, "The secret source of humor is not joy, but sorrow. There is no humor in heaven." Worth thinking about. Laura Trombley is an internationally renowned Twain scholar. As I said, she's authored several books and dozens of scholarly articles on Twain. She appeared in Ken Burns' documentary on Mark Twain, and as a graduate student, she discovered the largest known cache of Mark Twain letters. Hopefully we'll hear more about that tonight, or certainly someone in the audience is going to ask her about that. In addition to her most recent book, her other works on Twain include Mark Twain and the Company of Women and Constructing Mark Twain, New Directions in Scholarship. And in addition to being an author, she is also the president of Pitzer College. So she's a very busy person, and we're very fortunate to have her here tonight. After Laura's talk, we will open up to questions from the House. Maureen will be circulating a microphone, and please do wait until it comes to you as we record for podcast. And afterwards, Laura will be signing her book in the lobby. Please join me in welcoming Laura Trombley to the library. Thank you.
It's wonderful to see you all here this evening. And I think I should probably start with my favorite Twain quotation, "Always do right." Actually, this is a good quotation for all of you and for college presidents and probably corporate CEOs. "Always do right, you will gratify some of the people and astonish the rest." It's a pleasure to be here, and I want to thank Aloud. I feel particularly lucky that this is scheduled for a Tuesday night and not a Monday night, or we'd be all outside, wouldn't we? Your efforts are extremely important, and I think everything that we can do to support libraries and to make them growing and living places, as a child who grew up in a library, we all need to come together and do our best to support them. And so here you are. I will now give you a term that Twain scholars use to describe themselves, Twainiacs. We adore Mark Twain. I've been working with Twain since 1986, and I obviously can't get enough of him. We're gathered here together today. Twain would be thrilled, and in fact, you're doing exactly what he had planned the last 10 years of his life, to come and honor him at this point. He would be less happy with me, and probably he would be having me served with papers, because he would not be very happy about the work that I've done, where I've managed to figure out some secrets that he intended to keep very, very quiet. That having been said, though, I wanted to just describe a little bit for you about the context of Mark Twain's studies and what I've done, and then dive into the book. And I just want to say, I'm very excited because tonight I'm actually going to use slides. I have five of them, and I hope it works for you because I'm pretty excited about it. So with Twain, this blazing comet of genius came to us in 1835, and he managed to live to age 74 at a time when the actuarial tables dictated that he would probably leave at age 47. During his lifetime, he wrote over 50,000 letters. Over 13,000 of them still survive. He wrote more than 3,000 newspaper magazine articles, over 30 books. He also wrote plays, not very good, poetry, awful, and some excellent short stories. And while he's been dead for over a century now, you'd hardly notice it. His latest work is being published in November. He is, as far as I know, the only author who managed to arrange a publication date 100 years after he died. And he has been featured in news accounts and in blogs all over the world for the past few months. April 21st, a day that Twain people had been waiting for a very long time, that was actually the anniversary of his death, and this is now the celebration throughout the year, and you will see many more stories and probably more publications emerge. We should probably just accept this really is a Mark Twain world. It's easier that way. And it's an observation that he would gladly endorse, but only if he was generously compensated. At the end of his life, he was the most highly compensated author in history. He was paid 30 cents a word, and that's in 1909 dollars. He remains a major scholarly and commercial industry. Even during his life, his name, Mark Twain, was recognized as a brand as well as a pseudonym. Books about Twain sell, much like books about the Civil War, Abraham Lincoln, fly fishing, vintage wines, and in a moment of self-reference, obviously, hopefully, my biography. Twain impersonators roam the countryside. In fact, there's a Twain impersonator who has made quite a good living for himself, working the circuit in the South, and his entire program is Mark Twain for President, and now Hal Holbrook has been doing Mark Twain longer than Mark Twain did Mark Twain. Academics gather frequently to celebrate his life, legacy, and literature, and he is exceptionally well represented in cyberspace, where I did a quick Google search the other day, and in just under half a second came up with 22 million hits, 18 million ahead of Walt Whitman, and 19 more than his admirer Ernest Hemingway. And we should also accept our complicity in doing exactly what Twain wanted us to do, and that is make him an American icon. Now, critiquing his writings and his life can really be an intimidating experience. How can your views possibly compete with what Charles Kuralt said? If I had to say as much about America as I possibly could in two words, I would say these two words, Huck Finn. Or Hemingway's famous dictum, all modern American literature comes from one book by Mark Twain called Huckleberry Finn. There was nothing before, and there has been nothing as good since. Twain certainly knew how good he was. My books are water. Those of the great geniuses, wine. Everybody drinks water. However, right now, and perhaps for too many people, Mark Twain is either that animatronic statue at Disney World, or he is the practiced Hal Holbrook. The Twain that biographers have portrayed in the century since his death really run the gamut. We now have the damaged son of a castrating mother, split personality, a womanizer, impotent man, child molester, hypochondriac, gold digger, abusive spouse, neglectful father, misogynist, alcoholic, freedom fighter, and a white saint. With such a rich pedigree, he would make a perfect subject for a Bravo reality series. The New Jersey Housewives better watch out. A fleet of critics also disagrees about Twain's outlook on life, endlessly debating whether his life was ruled by a growing sense of disappointment with the human race or whether he was able to maintain his keen sense of humor. In the most simplistic of terms, sometimes the debate among academics breaks down into an argument about whether he was happy or sad at the end of his life. The public version for nearly a century has been that Twain went to his death a beloved, wisecracking, iconoclastic American undeterred by life's sorrows and challenges. And Twain certainly promoted this perception. "I am not an American," he wrote. "I am the American." All right, now here's the exciting part. the slides. Okay. When I speak to high school students, and I do this quite frequently, I will ask them at the start of my lecture to close their eyes and to imagine what Mark Twain looks like. And it is always surprising to me and impressive that the image that they typically describe is this one. And I call this the full Twain. In this image, sometimes students say that he resembles Colonel Sanders a little bit, but this is Twain at the very end of his life when he wore all white. And this is the image that anyone who does biography has to try and penetrate. And this was a mask that was very carefully constructed. In fact, it took Twain about 15 years of thought to finally develop and perfect this image. And if you think of something like this, this is exactly what Twain wanted you to see. And when you consider how effective that branding is a century after he passed away, it really is very impressive what he managed to achieve. Now, he didn't always look this way. Next slide. I have it. He once wore darker clothing, and he had a nice floppy tie in the style of his day, but most people don't think of this person as Mark Twain. Then you have the naked Twain. He actually was not posing for a magazine cover. He was posing for a lovely bust that was being made of him. Twain was utterly, joyously narcissistic. And when you work with Twain, there are hundreds of photographs for you to see. And his perfectionism was such, when it came to crafting his image, probably my favorite photograph, which I won't show you, that'll be for next time, is Twain is posing at the end of his life in the full white, and on his lap is a kitten. He loved kittens. It is quite true that he was very attracted to cats, and they were his favorite animals. However, because at that time, in order to take a photograph, you had to pose for quite a long time and you had to be very still. If you study the photograph, the kitten is porcelain. And here's the young Twain, Twain that probably most of us would never think about. And the work that I do consists of peeling away all of these layers of Twain. So in the end, aha! We start with the bare bones of Twain. A place that he was not comfortable with, and he never wanted anyone really to go. So Samuel Clemens, Mark Twain. In the beginning, there was just one. A boy born into a family that was already mourning the death of his brother Pleasant a few years earlier. Maturing from a child into a young man, he became expert in the paintings, poetry, and dark dress of 19th century bereavement. Growing up, he sleepwalked, suffered from nightmares, and would see two of his siblings, Margaret and Benjamin, into an early grave. And while Twain wrote about everything, he did not write about his mother's reaction to seeing her children die one after the other. His mother, Jane, was not optimistic about his survival either, pronouncing that he was a poor-looking object to raise. When he was 11, his father died a broken man, plunging the remaining family members into poverty. At age 22, he watched his brother Henry die. He had inhaled steam while working on a Mississippi River boat, and Twain had actually encouraged him to join him on the river. And he slowly passed away after about 2 or 3 days, and he was with him, and he never forgave himself for his brother's death. 3 years later, he left the Mississippi and headed out west with his older brother, trying to escape the carnage of the Civil War. In February 1963, he was in Nevada Territory, working for the Territorial Enterprise. That's where he first used the name Mark Twain, and the one became two. Considering his death-drenched past, it really isn't all that surprising that he should select as his pseudonym a term that denotes safety. Mark Twain, Mark Twain. Here you're safe. Here nothing will happen to you. here you may pass along the river. Marrying Olivia Langdon in 1870 would dramatically change his life for the good. Yet even here, within the happiness of his domestic circle, death continued to haunt him. He lost his first child, Langdon, in 1872, although it was here with Olivia and his three young daughters that he experienced his greatest happiness. It was during 20 years from 1870 to 1890 that he wrote what we now consider to be his classic works of fiction. And he wrote most of those at Quarry Farm in Elmira, New York. During that time, he was hailed not only as a genius in terms of his literature, but also for his business acumen. No one was as interesting or as fascinating a figure as Twain was in those days. However, in the decade of the 90s, he would say goodbye to his mother, his brother, and his favorite daughter, Susie. In Pudd'nhead Wilson, he summed up the tragedy of experience. All say how hard it is that we have to die, a strange compliment or a strange complaint to come from the mouths of people who have yet to live. With death always striding in lockstep beside him, he tried his damnedest to keep the darkness at bay. He made jokes about the hardness of life. He satirized Emmeline Grangerford in Adventures of Huckleberry Finn and the whole culture of 19th century grieving. And he signaled his resistance to the darkness by refusing to dress in the dark hues that men commonly adopted at the time. By the end of his life, after having seen so many members of his family disappear, he elected to only wear white. And by the end of his life, he owned over 24 white suits, and they each cost about $1,500 in today's dollars. The turn of the century, though, would be the hardest for him, losing his wife and sister in 1904. In the fall of 1906, he declared to his secretary that he would no longer don anything except the white dress. He would change into a fresh suit if he detected even the smallest spot. There would be no trace of death on Mark Twain. By the time his youngest daughter, Jean, passed away in 1909, he had lost his defiance and his humor, and he asked a rhetorical question in the elegy that he wrote about her: "Would I bring her back to life if I could do it? I would not." Somewhere along his 74-year journey, the two merged, the man and the pseudonym, like the Mississippi slipping its banks, ultimately carving out this unique persona that really has never had an equal in American literature. And trying to separate the strands as a biographer is like trying to keep bottomland and the Mississippi from bleeding together. And so let me just talk a little bit about what I tried to do in Mark Twain's Other Woman, which really chronicles the last 10 years of Twain's life. After having such a difficult life, where he had enormous success and also terrible tragedy, where the only real analogy he could find for himself was to compare himself to Halley's Comet, calling himself and Halley's two freaks of nature. We came in together, we'll exit together. Twain became obsessed with creating a legacy that would be so powerful that he would be forever known as America's greatest writer and America's best father, as well as instantly recognizable. I think in two of those categories, he's doing fairly well. It was the best father that I was particularly interested in. And for years in the work that I had done with Mark Twain, I noticed that there were these very odd discrepancies that no one had ever really managed to explain that happened during the last years of his life and also things that had happened after his death. He had one surviving daughter, Clara Clemens, and odd things, like, for example, you have the most famous person on earth passing away and you put no marker on his gravesite. That struck me as slightly odd. On his gravestone, while all of the markers in the Elmira Cemetery have quotations, passages, something that has been chiseled into the side of the rock, Clara left her father's blank. And this is the person who's probably the most quotable American author in history. Clara had a daughter, Twain's only grandchild. She was 5 months pregnant when her father passed away, and she never told him that she was pregnant with his only grandchild. In fact, she didn't tell her daughter who her grandfather was until she was in her teens. Odd things that biographers had never really spent much time trying to figure out if they knew them at all. And so when I decided I wanted to look at the last years of his life, I knew that there was a person that he had spent a great deal of time with, and her name was Isabel Van Cleek Lyon. And very little was known about her and less ever written about her. However, the Mark Twain Project, which is located at UC Berkeley, had a box of her writings, and I asked if I could see them. And actually contained in the box, you had all of her journals and daily reminders, copies of correspondence, and I opened up one of the journals, and she was recording everything Twain did for 6.5 years. So because of her, we know what he was eating. He loved radishes. He thought they cured indigestion. The fact that when he wore his white suits by the end of his life, he liked a white velvet cape to throw on his shoulders because he thought that created a little bit more drama. What he was reading, who he was seeing, how he was feeling, and it constituted a remarkable record. I couldn't figure out why anyone hadn't really spent any time working on this. And so I decided that I would transcribe all of her writings, I would have it published as a reference book, and 50 Twain scholars would be extraordinarily pleased by this. You have to remember, I'm the author of Poetry and Epistemology, so, you know, I have small dreams. And I started to work doing these transcriptions, and what I discovered was that, first of all, it wasn't just the Twain Project that had her papers. So did the University of Texas at Austin, so the University of Wisconsin, so did Vassar, so did Trinity. So it took me 6 years traveling around the country transcribing these. No one had ever done any kind of cataloging. And as I started to do all these transcriptions, I realized that she was speaking in a kind of coded language and that she was making references to things that were happening in the home that I had never read about in any biography. And it only took me 10 years to figure out what she was talking about. And so here's a lesson from Mark Twain that I will give to you, because you look like a group that constantly obsesses over their legacy and how you want to be remembered and how you want to make sure that 100 years after your death, people will have only a particular image of you, and that's the one that you want them to have. Here's what you do, and this is exactly what Twain did. First, you hire your own biographer. This is key. And you make them financially dependent upon you. And if they ever start asking too many questions, then you just threaten to pull the project. And this is what Twain did with Albert Bigelow Paine. And he actually wrote what is now considered the standard, still, Mark Twain biography, 3 volumes published in 1912, 2 years after Twain's death. The second thing that you do is that you dictate an autobiography, say about 500,000 words, 5,000 pages in length, and you specify that the entire autobiography cannot be published until a century after your death. Although excerpts can be published along the way to generate royalties, keep your copyright intact, keep your name in front of the American public, and hopefully to whet everybody's interest to buy the ultimate version of the autobiography. And this is exactly what he did, and he also made it very clear that in the autobiography he was not interested in the truth, the truth's for squares. He was interested in talking about his life as he wanted it to have happened, which means you're always good looking. People think you're always funny. You win every bet, and everybody loves your writing. And this is what's going to be published in November, the first volume of his autobiography. The last thing that you do, just in case you have someone who knows you too well and they know some secrets and you want to make sure that they never step forward, is during the last 12 months of your life, you spend 5 of them writing a 427-page blackmail document. And that's what he did about her. And he then gave this blackmail document to his daughter, Clara, who approached Isabel and who told her, if you ever try and step forward and say that you were part of our family's life, I will have this published, and you will be destroyed forever. Not a nice thing. And Isabel, at this point, she was no longer in Twain's employ, and she was so deeply frightened that she fled to Canada to live, so she could get away from the Clemens family. So this is exactly what Twain did. He was going to present that white image, and he was going to make sure that no one stood in his way. And for 100 years, nobody did, until me. And then I started to do all of these transcriptions, figured out that Isabel was trying to tell a story, eventually put the pieces together, and here's what happened. After Olivia's death in 1904, Isabel had been working for the family as a social secretary. However, Twain was at a loss with Olivia's passing and moved Isabel into the house. Previously, she had always lived outside, and he, in effect, made her a wife replacement of sorts. At that time, he had two daughters, Clara, the middle daughter, and Jean was the youngest daughter. His youngest daughter suffered terribly from epilepsy, and at times she could suffer up to 12 seizures a day, extremely ill. At a time when epileptics were feared, and there was such an enormous stigma attached to the disease that epileptics would often be locked up in prison. They could be taken to sanitariums. And here you have the daughter of the most famous man in the world with a disease that had to be kept secret. And it then came to Isabel. It all of a sudden became her job to take care of Jean and to protect her privacy. Isabel also, in addition to her social secretary and nursing duties, had to take care of Twain, and Twain had to be entertained constantly. And so she had to arrange outings for him, dinners for him, she had to manage the household staff, she had to purchase all of those white suits, make sure that they were kept clean. She would fluff his hair, she would rub his feet with iodine when he had the gout, she would care for him when he was ill, she oversaw the management of his final residence, Stormfield, located in Reading, Connecticut, and all for $50 a month, 24/7, no days off. That became her job. Clara, the middle daughter, suffered from having a father who was Mark Twain. And she did not like it. She didn't like the fact that everyone was not interested in her. And she was someone who desperately tried to create her own sense of identity separate from her father, but really was never very successful. And she was also well aware that her father's favorite, Susie, was no longer alive and that she was irreplaceable. So she had that oppressive weight as well. What Clara decided to do was that she was going to become a classically trained singer. The only problem with that was she's awful. She was a terrible singer, and no one really wanted to hear her sing. And it took me several years to figure out just how bad she was. And I finally determined that if someone walks up to you, if you're thinking of starting a singing career and says, you have a interesting alto, but it's queer and dark. That's not a good sign. And it wasn't until the 30s when I actually found a review that a critic did for the Detroit Free Press where he finally just described her voice as hideous. But she wanted to try and do something, so her father actually financially supported her tours, and she was often billed as Mark Twain's daughter. Very hard if you're trying to figure out who you are. And Clara was every bit as rebellious as her father, and she started to have an affair with her piano player. And he happened to be married, and he happened to have children. Isabel knew about the affair. Mark Twain didn't. And so Isabel was in a very difficult position. If she told Mark Twain, and Clara knew that she had, she would earn Clara's wrath. If she didn't tell Mark Twain and he found out, she would earn Twain's wrath because he wouldn't understand why she hadn't told him. And so in the end, Twain found out anyway. It had just become such a topic, there was such gossip, that finally news about the affair hit the newspapers. It became the talk of the countryside, and Twain was absolutely furious. Iconoclastic in his writings, not in his life, and not when it came to his daughters. He was not one who was going to entertain any kind of scandal. So he came up with an absolutely genius and horrendous solution. Isabel, who had been living with him for 6.5 years, all of a sudden he became very sensitive to the fact that they were living together. And he didn't want anyone to gossip about them. He was 27 years older than Isabel. So he determined that she would marry his business manager. And that way, she could still stay with him and be utterly dedicated to him, and there wouldn't be any unpleasantness about their relationship. He told Clara that she had to give up her piano player, and he found someone else for her to marry. His name was Osip Gabrilovich. He was also a pianist and a longtime friend of the family, and Clara had to agree to this because otherwise he would have cut her off. And she was very good at spending money, not great at earning money. And so the two women very unhappily wed. And Clara never, ever forgave Isabel because she thought that Isabel had told her father. And so Clara finally, as an act of revenge, convinced Twain that Isabel had been stealing from him. Now we're talking about someone who had watched his father have to declare bankruptcy, and Twain had had to declare bankruptcy when he was 59. That's actually what prompted him to go on the Around the World tour, was he was trying to make money so he could repay his debts. To wave a red flag in front of Twain about embezzlement was guaranteed to get a reaction. But in the beginning, he refused to believe Clara. Ultimately, though, he had to make a choice, and he chose family. And so he fired Isabel. But then he felt that perhaps he had made an enemy of not just Isabel, but particularly her husband, Ralph Ashcroft, who is a very, very zealous business manager and every bit as aggressive as Twain was. And what he did to Isabel was not just fire her and eventually write a blackmail document about her, but for years he had tempted her with the idea that after his death she would be allowed to edit an edition of his letters and keep 10% of the royalties. This is the way that he kept Isabel close to him. He also gave her a home of her own and 20 acres of land. After he fired her, obviously she wasn't going to edit anything, and he insisted that she give her home back to him free of charge, which she did. And so they were still so concerned that she might come out and tell family secrets that he wrote the blackmail document. Now, Twain dies April 21st, and just before his death, his youngest daughter, Jean, passed away. Her heart just failed. Severe epileptics, it's not atypical for their hearts finally to just give out. And that's what happened to Jean. So you had Clara, married to Osip, pregnant with Nina. You had Isabel, married to Ralph Ashcroft, and at that point they had fled to Canada. And so the two women knew of each other. Clara hated Isabel because she blamed Isabel for her unhappy life. And Clara was determined to make sure that Isabel was always going to remain invisible, to the extent that she actually had a private detective come and visit Isabel in the 1940s, pretending to just be someone interested in Mark Twain to see if Isabel would say anything about the family. There's this wonderful report from the detective entitled "Report About Miss X" that you can still read at the Bancroft. And Isabel didn't talk about anything like that. She just talked about how much she admired Mark Twain. But Isabel was no fool. She wanted very desperately to be remembered, but she had to do it in secret. And so she worked with a couple, the Websters, Dorothy and Samuel Webster, and they actually did a transcription of all of her writings, And she was determined to have that published, but she had to wait until Clara died. She was also determined that all of her writings would be kept, and so she worked out a secret deal with the director of the Bancroft Library and the Mark Twain Project that all of her papers would be stored there. And there's copies of correspondence where Dixon Wechter, who was the director at that time, agreed that they would indeed strike this deal and that her papers would be kept in a secret room and Clara would never be told. Last thing that she did, and this was during the late 50s, she met in her apartment with a young actor who was working on a one-man stage show, and he wanted to learn about Mark Twain. Through friends, he had found out about Isabel Lyon, and she agreed to meet with him but stated that he could never tell anyone about their meetings, that he could never mention her publicly, and that any reference that he had that he made about Twain could never be connected to her. And so night after night, she met with Hal Holbrook. And she talked to Hal about how Twain told a joke, how he would walk across the stage, the kind of tone that he would use in his delivery. And so the Twain that Hal's been doing now since 1955 is the Twain that Isabel gave him. And the two women waited for the other one to die. And Clara won. She outlasted Isabel. Isabel passed away in the late 1950s. And by this point, Clara's first husband, Ossip, had passed away. And, of course, she moved to Hollywood, bought a house under the Hollywood sign, and she married Jacques Samasoud, an itinerant Russian gambler and musician, 20 years younger than herself. She saw her daughter, Nina, for 20 minutes a day. She would allow her to come in the afternoon. They would have tea, make polite conversation. She would then send Nina on her way, and Nina would immediately start drinking. Jacques eventually gambled Clara out of her home in Hollywood, and they wound up living in the Bahia Hotel near San Diego, and in fact, the Bahia is still there. Clara passed away, and she disinherited her daughter. She left her nothing. She gave everything to Jacques. Nina sued, and eventually she was able to retain a third of the estate. Nina passed away. Actually, Nina committed suicide on Sunset Boulevard in 1963, and the entire family is buried in the Clemens family plot in Elmira, New York. And I love going to cemeteries because that's when you really see debts getting settled and you see scores being paid out and all of this kind of thing. When you visit the Clemens family plot, here you have Clara who has died, and then you had Nina follow her, or I'm sorry, you had Jacques and then you had Nina. Now, Clara specified who was going to be buried next to her. She chose Jacques, not her daughter. And so her daughter is buried away from her mother alone, and Jacques is buried next to Clara. However, the remaining members of the family on her mother's side so hated Jacques that he doesn't even get a headstone. It's just lawn. So you have Ossip, Clara, Lawn, and Nina. And that's where the family winds up. Now, the blackmail document, where did it wind up? Clara held on to it until the end of her life, just in case she needed it. She eventually gave it to her niece, Julia Loomis, who held on to it for about another 15 years. And then she passed away, and someone going through the attic found this manuscript, 427 pages. They had no idea what it was. It didn't fit into anything that had ever been written about Twain, never published, and it was extremely ugly, very, very, very ugly, calling Isabel all kinds of names. And so that was arranged for sale through a Twain collector to the Berg Library in New York City, where it currently is located today. And no one ever looked at it. However, as part of the autobiography, this blackmail document is going to be published for the first time. And this is the last piece of writing that Twain completed in his lifetime. and no one has ever read it except for me. I've read it a lot of times, but no one else really has ever read it in full, and so soon it will be made available for any of you who would like to read Mark Twain's last piece of writing. And so I wanted to end my remarks talking just for a moment about Isabel and this funny work that I do, biography. I call biography the only genre that bleeds, because ultimately you're talking about human beings and you're talking about people's strengths and also how fragile they are, about their loves and their dislikes, and the dislikes last for generations. And in working with Isabel's papers, I became aware that she still had direct descendants. And so one day I cold called her great nephew, David, in Connecticut. And I introduced myself. This was in 2002. And he cut me off and he said, "I don't have anything to sell you. I'm done with you Twain people. I'm finished. I've had enough of this." And I said, "You know, what's happened?" And he said, "You know, whenever anyone has written about Isabel, they always portray her as this terrible, awful person. I knew her as a boy. She'd always give me a little bit of change, and I loved her. And I can't bear reading the things that you people say about her." And I said, "I can certainly understand that, but I've been reading a lot about her, and I've thought a lot about her." And he interrupted me again, and he said, "Well, do you know what he said about her?" And I knew exactly what he was talking about, because in a letter that Twain had written to his daughter, bragging about how badly he had treated her, Justin Kaplan published it in his biography of Twain. And in that letter, he calls her a thief, a drunkard, a humbug, and a salacious slut. And I said, "Yes, I know what he said about her." He said, "So do you think she was a slut?" I said, "No, I don't think she was a slut. I think it's a much more complicated story than that." And I asked if I could come visit him, and he said, "All right, you can come up." So I went and I met with David and his wife and their daughter, and for 3 hours I told them everything that I knew about Isabel Lyon. And at that point, I knew more about Isabel Lyon than I know about my mother at that age, because I've never studied my mother at that age. I just lived with her. So at the end, they came and said, "Well, do you want to see some letters?" I said, "Sure, I'll see some letters." And they had some photographs as well, which they gave me, and all of those are in this book, and they've not ever been published before. And I wanted to read just one passage that was contained in one of those pieces that the family gave me. And this was something that Isabel wrote towards the end of her life. "Sitting alone in a little room in an old house in Montreal, I'm thrown back through the years by a single packet of written matter, which proves to be the forms dictated by Mr. Clemens to me as his private secretary. For answer to letters, invitations, the gifts of books, his private secretary. So private that the very mention of me is withheld from the world by the turn of fate. Private." So when the book was finally published, I had sent a copy of it to the Moore family, and I didn't even know if they still had the same address. I gave them my cell phone number, and it was actually in St. Louis, the first stop on my book tour. My phone rang, and it was Laura Moore, David's daughter, and she said in her kind of flat Connecticut accent, "Well, I read the book." And I said, "Yes." And I was very nervous because people go crazy around Mark Twain, particularly those who feel as though they have some kind of connection or they have his papers. Just odd things happen, and you never know what's going to take place. She said, "Yep, I finished it." I said, "All right." And she said, "You know, you finally gave her voice. She hasn't had one for 100 years. And she said, "She's in heaven and she's smiling." And I thought, so it took me 16 years. You know, seems like it's all worth it in a way. And that meant more to me than just about anything in working through this. So in addition to figuring out a story that Twain was determined nobody was ever going to be able to figure out, which is tons of fun. It is equally important to me that this person, who really was an intelligent woman and who had so much to say and always only said positive things about someone who didn't really treat her very well, was finally allowed to come forward and have her voice. And so I just want to thank you all for coming. As you can tell, I love talking about this subject. And once again, I really appreciate your support for the library. So thank you. And if you have any questions, I will do my best to answer them. Are there any questions?
A friend has written a manuscript about Mark Twain and his relationship with one of his daughters and sort of bordering on abuse. Mm-hmm. Could you talk about that?
A friend, did you say?
A friend of mine, but that's secondarily. Just Mark Twain and his perhaps abusive relationship with his daughter?
I know nothing about it. Okay. I don't think, in terms of abusive, I can say this, and this just concerns the period that I'm writing about. Twain's relationship with his daughters was a very difficult one, particularly as they grew up. He loved the daughters when they were young, and they constituted a kind of reading circle for him. And coming from the difficult family life that he had had, it was very important to him to have an intact family. However, as the daughters grew up, the family circle began to fray, and he was totally ill-equipped to deal with a daughter who was as ill as Jean was with epilepsy. And after his wife passed away, she had always been the person who was really parenting Clara. And so there was no firewall, in a sense. And Clara and Twain rarely could even stand to be in the same room with each other. And so Clara just found her father's temperament to be more than she could contend with. And I think it had to have been extraordinarily difficult to have as your father someone who was at that level of celebrity. And this is someone where, at the end of his life, cigar boxes would have as their advertising slogan, "Mark Twain, known to everyone, liked by all." And so she just found this to be a very difficult burden for her. And it obviously had some fairly tragic consequences. Any other questions? Mm-hmm.
Thank you. May I first off thank you for a very, very enlightening and a very, very stimulating evening.
Well,
my compliments.
You.
But I'm always curious. Obviously, this is a great master of American language, if you will, or mm-hmm. literature. I occasionally try and read work that would tell me what was Twain's educational background or his influence by other authors or just his searching that you think allowed him to educate himself or be mm-hmm. educated to master that kind of, I would call it a genius, if you would please.
Sure. His formal education ended at age 11. When his father passed away, his mother Jane was no longer able to keep all of the children at home. And that's when she apprenticed him to a printer. And I think that's, frankly, where his real education began, because as a result of that, Twain had to set type, and he wound up reading far more than any children that age ever would. And he was able to see stories as they would come in. He was part of a whole world outside of Hannibal. And for an obviously bright child to have what was, in effect, a kind of changing library every day was enormously valuable for his growth and development. Now, Twain would tell you that he never read, that all of his stories just came from the muse, and that he was a genius, and he didn't need to have any external influences. Of course, this is a lie. He had a library that constituted thousands of volumes, and so for works like Connecticut Yankee, he had done an enormous amount of reading in medieval history. For personal recollections of Joan of Arc, he was well aware that Joan of Arc was not just an interesting historical figure, and he had done a great deal of research into her, but also she was a symbol of the temperance movement, and he thought if he wrote a book about Joan, he would have an immediate audience who would be hopefully purchasing the work. In Adventures of Huckleberry Finn, you can see how he uses as his narrative template the same kind of template that was used for women's books, always starting with the orphan. And you can also trace elements that he lifted from popular women's books of the day, popular novels that had been written by women. He was enormously influenced. And some of the other research that I've done, I discovered that he maintained an active correspondent with over 100 women writers and journalists. And he once remarked that he had not had an active literary friendship with men, that in fact it was more with women. So he was always reading. He was extremely interested in what was going on around him. And he wound up marrying a highly educated woman. Olivia Langdon actually attended Elmira College, which was one of the first colleges in the country to offer degrees to women that were equal to men. And Elmira College was also founded in part by her father. So the Langdons were very much involved in educational efforts for women, healthcare for women. So they were socially progressive. They left their church when they refused to sign an abolitionist pledge. Her father was a conductor on the Underground Railroad. So this was a very educated and very literate family that Twain joined. And I think that that was part of the attraction for him, was because he wanted to continue feeding his own intellect.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Go, you can pick.
My question is about President Grant and Mark Twain. As I understand it, Mark Twain was quite an admirer of President Grant, mm-hmm. but President Grant would never have been able to finish his memoirs if Mark Twain had not pushed him. Is that story true?
Well, I don't know how much you pushed General Grant. It is true, though, that Grant had, for the most part, finished his memoirs, and he had entered into a contract with a publisher that Twain didn't think was going to compensate him appropriately. And Grant at the time was dying from throat cancer, and he was very concerned that with his death his family would be plunged into poverty, something Twain knew very well. So what Twain did is he offered to publish Grant's memoirs through his own publishing company, the Webster Publishing Company, which he did, and he, in the end, was able to deliver a check to Grant's family for $400,000, and that's tax-free $400,000 during the 1880s. And so Twain saved them from insolvency. And that sale made Twain very keen on owning his own publishing company. That way he wouldn't have any middleman that he had to deal with, and so he could actually make a greater profit for himself. They actually did manage to publish some works that sold very well. However, what ultimately ended the Webster Publishing Company was he decided that they would publish a biography of the Pope, because they were sure that every Catholic in the world would buy a copy. Apparently not. And so they had invested quite a bit of money in this, and ultimately the company did not survive. Twain was famous, and you may think of Twain as a failed businessman, which he was in his wildcat investments. He would invest in things like the self-sticking scrapbook, or a history game that nobody liked, or the most famous is the Page typesetter that never worked, and he sunk a quarter of a million 1880s dollars into that, and that eventually drove him into bankruptcy. But the smartest thing that he ever did was in December 1908, he actually trademarked himself, his name and his image, and he wanted to do that also to protect his royalties. And he was the first artist to ever trademark their and copyright their image. And so everything that has come since then, that entire branch of copyright law, that you can trace to Twain. So if any of you own the Britney Spears new perfume, she's actually making profits because of the precedent that Twain set. She should be very grateful. Any other questions?
Mm-hmm. For someone who grew up such a hard-scrabbled life, were Twain's kids privileged in their upbringing, and did he have any, or did he make any effort to sort of give them a sense of humility about their station in life relative to how his life began and his upbringing?
I think his children lived a life that other children couldn't imagine with the kind of privilege that they had. Although I think a good explanation for that is because his life was so difficult, he wanted to offer them an almost idealized form of childhood. And he enjoyed their childhood, I think, as much as they enjoyed it, and he mourned the loss of it more than they did. Did he try and give them a sense of what was around them? I think that probably was more Olivia than Twain, quite frankly. If any of you have ever been to the Hartford home, and if you haven't, it is an experience. It really is. It's extraordinary. That was constructed in the 1870s at a cost of $125,000. And they've done an incredible job of just extensive restoration. So it truly is sublime. And it actually coined its own architectural term, steamboat Gothic. And when you go and you see the house, it basically sits on that side of the hill in Hartford. And when I first gazed upon it, all I could think of was Twain standing there screaming, "Look at me! You know, look how well I've done!" Because his rise was just unbelievable. And you have to, you know, the difference between fiction and nonfiction is fiction has to be believable. Twain led a life that was absolutely almost a fantasy. And he didn't want to go back to that life that he once had had. And he tried going back to Hannibal later on in life, and that was really, I'd say, a fairly unhappy experience for him because he had a certain image of it and he didn't want to revisit it in reality.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. I am not a Twain addict, and I have read, as many school children have, the usual Mark Twains, and when you showed the first slide, that's the image that I grew up with thinking, and then the other slides are quite new to me. I've read your book. It's fascinating. I'd like to talk, though, about the control of the image that he had. Mm-hmm. Until now, it's been, as you know, very, very controlled in what we think about him. Now, in reading this book, I got an entirely different view of him. Now, the unedited autobiography is coming out, which mm-hmm. will probably shed even more light on it. And other than Lizzie Custer, who controlled George Armstrong Custer's image until she died.
And he published her memoirs of her husband.
That's right. I don't know of any other PR savvy man. Lizzie was the savvy one, and Custer, not George. He was dead already. But with Mark Twain, everything was so calculated, it seems. Mm-hmm. And are you not, as a scholar, you want the truth. Do you think now that the autobiography is going to come out that people now will look upon him in a very different light, not aside from his genius, but as the man, as the control about the father and the living domestic relationships, the right. dysfunctionality of the family?
Well, as a scholar and someone who has spent most of her adult life working in an archive, getting to what I consider to be the bones is very important to me. By the way, I did not give this book this title. The sexy title comes from my editor. So it's a sexy title book with 700 footnotes. And so I really want to have what... As close as I can get to what happened and to be as honest and without agenda as I can be in the retelling. When I started this, as I said, I thought it was going to be a reference work for 50 people. I had no idea that this story was going to emerge. You do have different factions just in Twain scholarship. You have the no, he was happy, and the actually he was kind of sad camp. I don't like those kinds of... categories, I think they're false. He had a very, very complicated life. He had struggles from the time he was born to having to try and grasp what it meant to be a celebrity at a global level. There was nobody before him. There was no template. There was no model for that kind of life. He had, obviously, a very complicated family life. I've had people ask me, does this make him any less of a writer? Absolutely not. I think it's miraculous that with everything that happened to him, think of the blazing genius that had to exist in order to keep on going. This is someone who literally could not stop himself from communicating. Anyone who writes 50,000 letters, it is stunning the need that he felt to express himself. The work that I've done, I think what it does is it takes us away from that plaster alabaster statue that currently exists as Twain and tries to open him up and reveal him as a person and someone who had some issues in his family that are in many ways very contemporary. And this adds to our understanding of a very, very complex person rather than in any way, you know, it may change him, but I think it also gives him back to us, because in the end, he controlled himself so much that he almost managed to drain out of himself what we love about his works, which is their humanity. And so it's trying to return a little bit to the person that he was. I'll let you choose, because you're closer.
In the time that Twain wrote, Tolstoy was also a highly recognized writer on the other side of the world. Has anyone kind of compared their relative geniuses and evaluated that in any scholarly way?
I'm sure someone has. I didn't. However, when you think about Twain's scholarship, Twain, for anyone who has any designs on becoming part of American literature in terms of any kind of profession, if you are going to earn your doctorate, if you're going to become an American literature professor, it's a rite of passage. At some point, you will probably write something about Mark Twain. Every year, when you look at just that year's references to articles and books that have been written about Mark Twain, you're looking, I think I measured it once, it's over 12 inches in terms of just the sheer density of the page that it takes up in an MLA listing. There are thousands and thousands and thousands of articles. If you decided that you wanted to become a Mark Twain scholar and read through all of the criticism, it would probably take you about 15 years to do it. So yes, I am absolutely sure that someone has written about that at some point. Did their paths ever cross? No. Did Twain know of him? He knew of everybody. He knew about everyone. I'm sure that he probably had read some of his pieces as well. But more than that, I can't say.
Hi, I'm fairly certain that in tonight's description, we were promised Mark Twain and drugs.
Ah.
So I just wondered if you could touch on that.
Okay, all right.
And just finally, do you actually like Mark Twain?
I love Mark Twain. I wish I had had the opportunity to have known him. I think I would have found him exhausting after a time. I've been working with him for almost 25 years, and after 25 years, I feel as though I'm only now beginning to appreciate the magnitude of the mind that was at work. He led an enormous life. He had an insatiable quest to find out what was next, to try and figure things out, and to express himself, and to also, he really was determined to create a new kind of American literature. He was, in effect, declaring in Adventures of Huckleberry Finn with that first sentence, "You don't know about me." In that first sentence, he forever changed American literature because no longer was a story being told to you. Huck was speaking directly to you. And in order for Huck to tell his story, you had to be part of that. And so you get to choose a role for yourself. Who are you going to be? Huck's playmate, Huck's father, Jim, in that kind of relationship. That had never happened before. And he created something that, as Hemingway said, and I don't agree with Hemingway about everything, it was a completely new direction and a new American voice. And I don't think anything can ever take that away from Twain. He was a great, great light. Now about the drugs. One of the things that, again, you find out odd things when you write biography and you go into areas that, I had very little knowledge about epilepsy. I had little knowledge about some of the other things, but by the end, you learn a lot about these things. And in Isabel's journals, she writes about taking Bromidia and dosing herself with Bromidia and how the family used Bromidia. I didn't know anything about Bromidia, and I started this book in 1993, which is pre-Google, and so it was much harder to get information. But luckily, it took 16 years. So by the end, I had tons of information. And so I Googled Bromidia, and as it turns out, there is a person in San Francisco whose life work is dedicated to demonstrating that all of the major pharmaceutical companies actually had their start in manufacturing patent medicines that contained enormous amounts of marijuana. This is his life's work. And he had pictures of the labels from Bromidia and the original bottles. And this was the most popular patent medicine at the time. And it contained copious amounts of marijuana, chloral hydrate, and alcohol. And ironically enough, it was advertised as a way to cure alcoholism. however, the instructions on the bottle of Bromidia was to take an eighth of an ounce until pain stops. So, thus guaranteeing they were going to remain a top-selling patent medicine. So I saw these images and the ingredients. I thought, wow, so now all of a sudden, all of these stories that Twain was writing at the end of his life, Captain Stormfield's visit to heaven and the universe and stars and all that. I think I'm starting to pick up a theme here. And so I actually published one of the labels from Bromidia in the book, and I tried to contact the person who runs this website with all of these old advertisements and bottles listed on it. And because I needed to get copyright permission from him. And He was very, very squirrely, and in fact would only identify himself as Dan. However, eventually I managed to get permission. So you can think of Twain at the end of his life ranting and raving as he's writing a blackmail document. At that time, he smoked 300 cigars on average a month. Yes, that's 300 cigars on average a month. He drank every day. He drank more if he didn't feel well. And whenever he'd feel a cold coming on, little bromidia. So that's the drugs.
I want to thank you for a wonderful talk. Thank you all for coming.
Thank you.
Aloud Audio is produced by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles and made possible through support provided by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, Righteous Persons Foundation, City National Bank, K&L Gates, KPMG, the Boujakji Foundation, Susan and David Rosenblum, Wallace Foundation, and Donna and Martin J. Wolf. Media support provided by KPCC 83.9 FM, KUSC 91.5 FM, and public television station KCET. Additional support provided by the Council of the Library Foundation and individual Library Foundation members. Aloud theme composed by Larry Karish.